everybody, and welcome back to I Just Want to Talk About the Bible. If this is your first time joining us, then welcome. I'm very glad that you're here. My name is Christian Keeter, and I live in the southeast of the United States of America with my amazing, beautiful, godly wife, Lacey, and our two wonderful daughters, Felicity and Serenity. So without much of an introduction today, we're just going to hop right into the text. And as we discuss this first passage, as well as others, the point of this episode will become clear. So the passage is out of 2 Samuel chapter 5 in the Old Testament, which, by the way, studying the Old Testament is so crucial and so vital, and there are so many incredible lessons to learn out of the Old Testament and wonderful principles. And honestly, the more we understand the Old Testament, the more we'll understand the New Testament. I know that studying the Old Testament can seem daunting or overwhelming at times, but it's definitely worth the time to study both the Old and the New, the whole Bible. So having said that, let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 5. Just a little bit of context real quick before we hop into the passage. This is about King David. He has just recently been anointed king, and for those of you who are familiar with the story of David, you'll recall that he had been anointed way back in 1 Samuel chapter 16 by the prophet Samuel, but that much time passed between his anointing and him actually ascending to the throne. Saul had been the king up to that point, and the kingdom had been taken away from him and was being given to David. But in the interim, Saul pursued David, he sought his life, and Saul ultimately died in a battle that's recorded at the end of the book of 1 Samuel. So that's a very brief overview. We could spend an entire episode talking about David and Saul, and that would be a wonderful use of time, but maybe that's another conversation for another day. So in 2 Samuel chapter 5, I'm going to be beginning in verse 17, down here, I guess, about closer to the end of the passage. And so David has been anointed king. So let's just read 2 Samuel 5:17 and then pause. 2 Samuel 5:17 says, "When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold." So let's stop there. Just really quickly, it says the Philistines were coming to search for him. That might be a familiar name, the Philistines, because a very famous opponent of Israel came from the Philistines, namely Goliath, whom David fought and killed in 1 Samuel 17. So the Philistines were recurring opponents and enemies of Israel. And here in 2 Samuel 5, we see the Philistines mustering against David. So that's the setting, that's the context here. So resuming in verse 18 of 2 Samuel 5, it says, "Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim, and David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand.' And David came to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, 'The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood.' Therefore, the name of that place is called Baal Perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, 'You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines.' And David did as the Lord commanded him and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer." So that's the end of the passage there. It's just kind of fun. It's a fun passage to envision. You have this opposing army come up, and David seeks the Lord. The Lord gives him wisdom, and David obeys what the Lord shows him, and there's this battle, and the Israelites win, and then the battle happens again, and the Lord gives him different instructions, and the Israelites win again, and it's just a cool scene to think about, this them spread out in this valley. But I want to draw a couple things out of this passage, and as I draw these things out, hopefully you'll see how quickly this passage begins to apply to each of our lives. So let's just look at a few details here. The passage that I read in its entirety there was 2 Samuel 5:17 through 25, is through the end of the chapter. But let's just point out a few details. So there are two battles that take place here. There are two battles. And the army that's opposing Israel is exactly the same. It's the Philistines both times. And I point out something else that's exactly the same, and that's the location of the battle. Let me highlight this by reading the passage again. So 2 Samuel 5:18 says, "Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim," the valley of Rephaim. Then down in verse 22, it says, "And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim." So you have the same enemy fighting in the same location. Yet when David seeks the Lord, God gives him different instructions. Did you notice that? The first time, in verse 19, it says, "And David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand.'" And that's the end of verse 19 there. So the first time David inquires of the Lord, he seeks the Lord, and the Lord gives him the green light to go and fight the Philistines, and the Lord gives them victory over the Philistines. Coming down to the second battle here, it says in verse 23, "And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, 'You shall not go up.'" Let's just pause there for a second before I finish reading what the Lord said. "You shall not go up." Previously, it says, "And the Lord said to David, 'Go up.'" That's in verse 19. Here in verse 23, it says, "You shall not go up." So it's the opposite. Even though all the other circumstances are identical, same enemy, same location, the Lord's giving a very different instruction. So I'll finish reading what the Lord said in verse 23. He said, "You shall not go up, but go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." And that also included verse 24 there. So this is very fascinating. It's very interesting. And same scenario, very different instructions. Now, what would have happened if David had not sought the Lord the second time? What would have happened if David had thought, "Well, you know, the Lord did it this way previously, we can just assume he's going to do it that way again," and go up to fight the Philistines again the exact same way that he had the first time, not going around the rear among the balsam trees and all that stuff, but just kind of going directly up against them? Well, we can't say for 100% sure because it's just speculation, but a strong case can be made that David may very well have likely lost that battle. At the very least, what we can say with certainty is that God's direction for him was totally different the second time. The result was the same, victory, in both situations, but the means of achieving that victory was different. God gave him different instructions. And so I want to compare this, or I guess contrast it, really, with something else that happened earlier in the Bible with another warrior leader named Joshua. So let me flip over here, and I use the term flip very loosely because I'm actually typing into the computer, not flipping any pages technically here. So into Joshua chapter 6. Now, arguably the most famous account in the entire book of Joshua and the entire career of Joshua, for that matter, is going to be Jericho. So we're going to revisit this passage in Joshua chapter 6. And I'm going to read some of the verses. I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but we really need to understand this if we're going to see the point that I'm trying to draw out here. But before reading in Joshua, just a little bit of context work. We should always be good students and ask the question of context. Joshua is the leader of Israel now. Moses died at the end of Deuteronomy, which is the book that comes right before Joshua, of course. The 40 years of wandering in the wilderness are done, and they're entering into the promised land that the Lord is giving them. And they are fighting against the inhabitants of the promised land, and the first battle that they encounter in the promised land is going to be the city of Jericho. So in Joshua chapter 6, verse 1, it says, "Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out, and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him.'" And so I'll stop there for now. So we see that the Lord is giving Joshua the battle plans for the battle against Jericho. Similar to David, whom God gave the battle plans when he was fighting the Philistines, God is giving Joshua the battle plans to fight against Jericho. We just read through those now. It's a famous image, visual that we're relatively familiar with the idea of marching around the walls of Jericho in the battle. Now, one thing that we know beforehand is you'll recall that Joshua had sent spies into the city, and Rahab the prostitute had helped hide the spies. And so there's this agreement that anyone in Rahab's house will be spared, but anybody else is going to be put to death. And so anyone in Rahab's house is spared. You'll hear a little bit about that here in this passage as we go down. Just wanted to bring that back to your mind as we read through this. So Joshua and the people follow the Lord's commands, and they march around the city. And we are going to pick up in Joshua chapter 6, verse 15, which starts on the seventh day that they were marching around it, which you'll remember from the instructions that the Lord gave them earlier in this passage. So let's begin in Joshua 6:15 and read down through 21. And bear with me as we go through all this. I'm going somewhere with this, and it's connected to what we just read about with David, and you'll see that in a moment. So beginning in verse 15, let's read down through 21. It says, "On the seventh day they rose early, at the dawn of day, and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times. And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, 'Shout, for the Lord has given you the city, and the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab, the prostitute, and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But you, keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all the silver and gold, and every vessel of bronze and iron, are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord.' So the people shouted, and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys, with the edge of the sword." And that's the end of the passage. So what I want to highlight here is this whole notion of where it talks about the things devoted to destruction, or even the silver and gold and the bronze and iron that are holy to the Lord. They have been given specific instructions about how to handle the spoil of Jericho. And it was to go into the treasury of the Lord, verse 19 says. This is very important to remember. So they weren't supposed to keep the spoil of the Battle of Jericho for themselves. They're supposed to go into the treasury of the Lord. Now, I will say that in other battles, they were allowed to keep the spoil. For example, in Joshua 8:2, it says, let's see here. This is the Lord speaking to Joshua. He says, "And you shall do to Ai and its king," Ai is another city that we'll talk about in a moment, "and you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king. Only its spoil and its livestock you shall take as plunder for yourselves. Lay an ambush against the city behind it." So that's the end of Joshua 8:2. And so I just want to draw that out to be like, this command for the army to not keep any of the spoil was not an across-the-board thing. It was applying to Jericho here. And so they were told not to keep any of the spoil, but to take the gold, the silver, and all that and put it into the treasury of the Lord. These things were devoted. And so with that knowledge, let's flip over to Joshua chapter 7. This is after the Battle of Jericho. And obviously, I didn't read all of Joshua 6. I just kind of pick some verses out of there to highlight some things. So in verse 7, beginning in verse 1, we'll read verse 1 and we'll pause. It says, "But the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel." So that's verse 1. So this guy Achan didn't do what he was supposed to do. He kept some of the spoil, some of the stuff that was to go into the treasury of the Lord. And so he kept it. And then Joshua, I'm going to keep reading here. Let's read verses 2 through 5. "Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, 'Go up and spy out the land.' And the men went up and spied out Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said to him, 'Do not have all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few.' So about 3,000 men went up there from the people, and they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them before the gate as far as Shebarim and struck them at the descent. and the hearts of the people melted and became as water. So that's through verse 5. So after this big victory at Jericho, there's this relatively small city of Ai, and there's this incredible victory at Jericho, followed by a real upset, a real defeat at this city of Ai. Moving on, it says in verses, beginning in verse 6 and following, it says, "Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, 'Alas, O Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Would that we had been content to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say when Israel has turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?'" So let's stop there. That's through verse 9. So Joshua goes before the Lord, and he starts just saying, you know, talking to the Lord about all this and lamenting what happened and just saying, what's going on? But listen how the Lord responds. And again, we could talk about all this from so many different angles. And I even acknowledge that while we talk through these passages, a lot of questions even come up. And maybe we can talk about those another time. But there's one specific thing that I'm trying to draw out here. It just requires a little bit of setup to get to it. So resuming in verse 10, the Lord responds. It says, "The Lord said to Joshua, 'Get up. Why have you fallen on your face? Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen and lied and put them among their own belongings. Therefore, the people of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies because they have become devoted for destruction. I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you. Get up, consecrate the people, and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow. For thus says the Lord, God of Israel, there are devoted things in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the devoted things from among you." And so I'll pause there. That's through verse 13. And so why the explanation for the defeat of Israel at Ai is that there was this kind of breach in their relationship with the Lord. The Lord even says, he says, "I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you." And so now this is kind of all coming to the surface, and they go through the process of discovering who it was, that it was Achan, and what he had taken. And then once they figure out who it was, they take Achan and his family and his belongings, it says, and all that he had, and they stone them with stones. And honestly, there are so many really incredible things that we could talk about, even just out of this passage, principles that we see that are just really, really valuable things, and just really good conversations we could have that I'm honestly fighting the urge from having those conversations right now because I'm just trying to keep us focused on the topic at hand. So again, I think this is the third time I said that, but maybe that's a conversation for another time. So then after this, you can go to Joshua chapter 8 and you can read about how Ai is defeated. Chapter 8 verse 1 goes on. It begins by saying, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not fear and do not be dismayed. Take all the fighting men with you and arise. Go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hand the king of Ai and his people, his city and his land. And you shall do to Ai and his king as you did to Jericho and its king. Only its spoil and its livestock you shall take as plunder for yourselves. Lay an ambush against the city behind it.'" And that was verses 1 and 2 of chapter 8. So God, just like with Jericho, gave Joshua a plan for Ai. Which, by the way, I find it interesting. It says, "Take all the fighting men with you." Whereas the spies said, "I'll just take a few thousand." And so I just want to, this is kind of what I'm wanting to draw out here. What does this have to do with David? What does this have to do with the passage out of 2 Samuel that we read earlier? This is what I want to point out. David did something that Joshua did not. And that thing that he did is this. He paused to seek the Lord. David was in two battles that were very similar. Same enemy, same location. But despite that, David stopped and sought the Lord and asked for his direction. With this account of Joshua, we see that Joshua gets the battle plans for Jericho. And he obeys the Lord and he does all that. And they take the city. But then they just kind of transition right to Ai. there's not, you don't see Joshua pausing to seek the Lord until after the defeat of Ai. After they already tried to go up there and they lost the battle. And this is what I'm wondering. If Joshua had stopped to seek the Lord, would those 36 guys have died that went up and lost to the battle of Ai? Do you see? They sent up a few thousand people, and it says about 36 of their men. In verse 5 of Joshua 7, it says, and the men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them, and it goes on a little bit further in that verse. But my point is just this. A defeat could have been avoided, probably, if Joshua had stopped to seek the Lord, because I just believe that if Joshua had stopped to seek the Lord would have told him what he told him anyways, beginning in verse 10, where he told him about the sin in the camp, about what had happened. Like, Joshua stopped to seek the Lord after the defeat, but if he had stopped before the battle, then it could have looked differently, and this issue could have been resolved before a loss happened. David stopped between the battles. And, you know, for Joshua, he's just doing what he was supposed to do from his perspective, probably. I mean, he's the leader of the Israelites. He's been sent into Canaan as the leader, and they're going to take the land, and he's just kind of doing it. But despite the similarity of the circumstance, it's good to stop and seek the Lord. And this is where the principle really interacts and intersects with our own life. We have to be diligent to seek the Lord and seek wisdom from Him. We talked about the value and importance of seeking wisdom from the Lord in episode 32 of this podcast recently called Connect the Dots. And so what I'm talking about today is a very specific way, or I guess application of seeking wisdom from the Lord, and that's this. Even if you've been in a situation very similar to the one that you're facing ahead of you, you should still ask God for wisdom. You should still pause and say, Lord, last time you led me to do this, but is there anything you want to say this time? Is there anything different you want me to do this time? Last time you figuratively told me to just go up and fight the Philistines. This time, do you want me to go around to the rear among the balsam trees? And is there something else that you want to do here? And the Lord may very well not have a different set of situations. It may be very much just go and do things as you had done previously. And again, right now, let me just clarify. I'm talking about wisdom in making decisions. Obviously, with matters of sin and righteousness, that's always straightforward. And if you were to say, you know, Lord, last time you told me not to sin, should I sin this time? It's like, well, no, the answer to that's always going to be no, right? Where sin is never, ever the right choice. But even with that example, doing the right thing and obeying the Lord and His word, that, you know, depending on the circumstance, what it looks like for you to apply His word might look different depending upon the circumstance. It's like, okay, the Bible says, Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. It's like, well, what it looks like to be a peacemaker in any given circumstance can vary from situation to situation. So even if you've been in a situation similar to the one that you've been in before, and again, just using the example of being a peacemaker, and you want to be a peacemaker, it's good to stop and seek the Lord, because what worked kind of in one situation might not go exactly the same way in the next situation. And so we need to pause and ask God to give us wisdom. This is vital. It's crucial. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 is a really famous passage, and it's relevant to what we're talking about. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make straight your paths. And so this is what we're talking about here. Trusting in the Lord with all of our heart, not leaning on our own understanding, in all of our ways acknowledging Him and asking Him to make our path straight. And so whenever we do something, we're like, well, this worked last time, I'm going to try it again. That can fall under the banner of leaning on our own understanding. Even if the last time we had a word from the Lord telling us how to do it, we need to ask the Lord, Lord, do you want me to handle this situation the same way that I did the previous one? And one more passage really quickly before I give you an example out of my own life as to how I learned this lesson. James 1:5 is a passage I've referenced recently. James 1:5 and 6 says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. So that's a passage that's just crucial anytime we're talking about asking the Lord for wisdom, because there's such confidence we can ask for wisdom with whenever we read passages like that. James 1, 5, and 6. Again, I spoke about this recently, and so I'm not going to reteach that again. But let me share with you kind of how I learned this lesson that I shared with you about David and Joshua. A few years ago, my wife Lacey and I were going on a vacation, and we had booked a bed and breakfast in the mountains of North Carolina, which is the state that we live in. And we had had good experience with bed and breakfast before. In fact, for our first anniversary, we went to a bed and breakfast, and it was just a wonderful experience. It was awesome, and it was great. And so we're thinking, you know what? That was awesome. Let's do that again. Just different location. Let's do this again, though. So same sort of situation, going on a vacation, finding a bed and breakfast. So we book it. We do all this stuff, and we're excited. It's about probably like a 5-hour drive to this place. So we get there, and we get to this bed and breakfast, and we kind of check in, I guess, and take our suitcase to the room, and neither one of us wants to say it because we don't want to, like, bring down the other person or kind of, you know, negatively affect just like the how we're enjoying the vacation. But both of us have this growing sense of unease at this place. We have this growing sense of something's not right. Like, and it was like, it was a spiritual thing. And there have really only been a handful of times that I've probably felt something this strongly when you're just kind of in a scenario and you're just really, really can feel it. And you're like, something is not right spiritually here. And I do not like how this feels. And so we go into town near this bed and breakfast, and we go, we eat food at this restaurant, and we're just not even able to enjoy ourselves. And honestly, on the drive up there, we had stopped at a gas station that was, it just seems like something really, really shady was going on at this gas station as well. And just really a bunch of really weird kind of things. And so we go back to the bed and breakfast, and we're talking about all this. And we just conclude, we're like, we gotta go. Like, and I'll just be completely honest with you guys, I don't know why. You know, I don't know why we felt this way exactly. Obviously, if we had stayed, maybe we would know why, but I don't want to know why if that's the case. But I just remember feeling like, I don't want to sleep in this place. Like, I do not want to go to sleep in this place. I do not want to stay here. And so we just really felt, and again, this is spiritual, just kind of this internal apprehension. You might be able to relate what I'm describing. And so Lacey and I talk about it, and we conclude that the best thing to do is to leave. And so we drive all the way back to our hometown. And so drive about 5 hours up there, turn around. We're leaving at sunset, and we get home at around 2 a.m. And so we drive all the way. So just 10-hour driving one day to and from the mountains of North Carolina. And we really thought this is the best course of action and that this was the best thing to do. And so as I was reflecting back on that, it's just like, well, what in the world was this? And that's how the Lord is really beginning to teach me this lesson, where it's like, you know, it worked fine the first time. We had a great experience with the bed and breakfast, but we just really want to pause and be like, okay, Lord, it was great that time. What about this time? Is this a good place for us to go stay? Is this a good location? Do you have something else for us? And just praying before making bigger decisions. Even though that decision doesn't necessarily seem like an intrinsically spiritual one, I guarantee you it felt like a spiritual one when we got there, and there was just something not right about that whole place. And so, and I don't know. And again, I don't know if it was specifically the bed and breakfast or what, like if there had been a different bed. I mean, the whole town didn't feel, it didn't feel right, to be completely honest with you. And so, and I don't want to ramble about that, but my point is just using that as an example of how I learned this, where it's like, okay, yeah, the first time it was fine. The first bed and breakfast we went to, but this time, no. And so we're going to pause and seek the Lord, ask him for wisdom, ask him to guide our steps, to give us his perspective on situations, even if previously something was okay, even if previously something went well. And so this seeking of wisdom that I'm talking about applies across the board. I already used the example of peacemakers. Lord, How do I look? How does it look like for me to be a peacemaker in this situation? It can be with regard to financial decisions. Lord, last time I made this sort of decision, it was a good sort of move financially. But is there some sort of pitfall I'm not seeing now? It could even be, you know, working with somebody, a business partner of some kind, where it's like, okay, I've worked with this person in the past, it went well. But does that mean I should automatically engage in another business venture with this exact same person? Why don't we pause to seek the Lord? So we could just continue to go through examples, is my point. We could continue to talk about all sorts of examples about this, and I hope that you've already begun to see them in your own life. But what would this lead to? This will lead to praying more. This will lead to you seeking the Lord more. This will lead to us having a more intimate relationship with Jesus because we're coming to him in prayer, asking for his wisdom and perspective, saying, Lord, what about this? What about that? What about this? Please show me. Please give me wisdom. And so not only will we be getting wisdom from the Lord, because he's promised wisdom to those who ask in faith, not only will we be getting that wisdom and, frankly, be avoiding a lot of unnecessary pitfalls, we will also be growing in our intimacy with Jesus Christ because we will be spending more time with him in prayer. This is important. We need wisdom from God. We really do. And so I hope that this was clear. I hope that you see the comparison with Joshua and David. I tried not to get too deep into details, which is hard for me because I love details, because I find them all very interesting. And the more you get, like, even on a really specific level in the Bible, the more incredible gems you can mine out. But just here today, I hope that it was clear, and I hope that it's encouraging, and I hope that it's applicable, as always. And so, hope that you guys are doing well. I hope that you are all growing in your relationship with the Lord and encountering him in fresh ways every single day. And I hope that this was encouraging. So until next time, God bless you guys. Take care.